There's a very common sense reason gold is pushing to all-time highs right now. Actually, there are several reasons. The cost of goods continues to rise despite interest rate controls by the Fed. Since Jan 21, the cost of living is up 17.9%. The national debt continues to skyrocket, now above $34 trillion, causing many to worry when the House of Cards will come crashing down. A presidential election year that'll have massive implications on the future of this country. All of this adds up to instability and uncertainty, and that's why so many Americans are turning to Birch Gold Group. Have you diversified your savings yet? Secure a portion of them with gold from Birch Gold. Text STRANGE to 989898 and get your free info kit. You'll learn how to convert an existing IRA or 401k into a tax-sheltered IRA in gold, and it doesn't cost you a penny out of pocket. With an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau and tens of thousands of happy customers, you can count on Birch Gold, too. Just text STRANGE to 989898 to claim your free info kit and to protect your savings from uncertainty today.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Dr. Richard Gallagher, coming down in 3, 2, and 1.
Richard Serrett's Strange Planet, following the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from the Great White North. And his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard.
And welcome to another episode of Strange Planet. On this episode, the world's leading psychiatric authority on demonic possession delves into the hidden world of exorcisms and his own transformation from cynic to believer over the course of his 25-year career. Dr. Richard Gallagher is a board-certified psychiatrist and a professor of psychiatry, educated at Princeton. He trained at Yale and Columbia, where he remained on the psychoanalytic faculty. He's a recognized medical expert on discerning cases of demonic possession, advises multiple clergy on the subject, and has undoubtedly seen more examples of true and false possessions than any other physician in the world. His book is called Demonic Foes, My 25 Years as a Psychiatrist Investigating Possessions, Diabolic Attacks, and the Paranormal. Dr. Richard Gallagher, welcome to Strange Planet. It's been a while. It's great to see you and hear you again.
Thank you, Richard. Yeah, we go back a while. I think I was mentioning to you that one of the exorcists who's highlighted in the book, a guy who called himself, and I use his nom de guerre in the book, Father A. Unfortunately, he's deceased, so I'd like to pay a little homage to my good friend. Just thank you for the introduction. One slight correction, and I think you got that from HarperCollins. They sort of said to my journey was from cynic to a firm believer. I don't know that I was ever cynical about this subject. What I did feel when I finished my residency and was approached by another exorcist, Father Jacques, not his real name, although everything else in the book is true, I certainly was somewhat pretty skeptical about ever seeing any of this stuff. If you may remember in the 80s and late 80s, early 90s, there was something called the Satanic Panic in America.
Yes.
Which hasn't entirely gone away. And everybody was seeing Satanists all over the place. And so I remember when this rumpled, very pleasant and erudite, but rumpled priest came to my office at Cornell Medical College and said, Dr. Gallagher, will you evaluate a case for me? I said to him, well, Father, with all due respect, I'm a little skeptical of that sort of stuff. And to my surprise, he said with a chuckle, well, then you're the perfect man for the job, because he wanted someone who wasn't seeing the devil everywhere, was rigorous in helping him discern cases. And in fact, that is required, certainly by most churches, including the Catholic Church, very much so, requires, at least in America, requires a psychiatric evaluation.
Right. So just for those not familiar with you or your incredible journey in this field, very quickly, you and I met back in, I believe it was around 2010, 2011, perhaps. I read a piece that you wrote for the Catholic Observer, if memory serves. Was it the Catholic Observer?
It was the New Oxford Review.
The New Oxford Review. My apologies. But this was, and the title was pretty sensational, described as the first authenticated, or an authenticated, not the first, but an authenticated case of demonic possession. This is coming from a board-certified psychiatrist, and I thought, oh my gosh, a man of science is basically saying, yes, I was treating a patient who was demonically possessed. And so my camera crew and I rushed down to Yonkers, New York, and we met, and the tale continues to chill me, haunt me to this very day. So just give us, I guess, the kind of the Reader's Digest version of this remarkable case of a demonic possession.
One other slight correction, and I know you're very knowledgeable about this field. So this was not a patient of mine. In fact, the people I write about in the book, Richard, are not patients of mine. I usually do these pro bono evaluations for the church. Now, it is true in her case, again, not her real name. I use the name Julia. In fact, if people Google the possession of Julia on the internet, remarkably, they will learn about this case. In fact, even Hollywood, you may know Jason Blum, even Hollywood is now interested in making a movie about this case. So it's a somewhat well-known case already. The reason I highlighted it in the book was because even in the eyes of the two exorcists, this priest I call Father Jacques and my good deceased friend, Father A, who was probably the most experienced exorcist in American history, in my opinion, even they described this as a once-in-a-century case. This was an incredibly flamboyant case. And if you think of the combination of factors that sort of fell in my lap because they wanted me to speak to her. They knew she was possessed already. They wanted me to speak to her because of her somewhat difficult and problematic background as one of these rare Satanists, whom I don't see all over the place. And they were concerned about her ambivalence about getting help. That was in part because she was a member of a cult. She was in love with its leader. She regarded herself as the high priestess and queen, remarkably enough. This was all verified, by the way. We had tremendous evidence about this, including some of us being threatened by the cult. So we took her fears seriously. But in addition to my sort of opportunity to speak to one of these rare, genuine Satanists. Number two, this was a truly once-in-a-century case of a possession. By that, I mean far more flamboyant than most. Possessions are rare, but by this point in my career, I've actually seen quite a few. Perhaps more than any doctor in history, as you sort of implied. Given Zoom, given telephone and all that. And number three, remarkably, I had pretty good rapport with her. I think she liked talking to sort of a doctor. She actually often disparaged priests. for various reasons. But I think she liked talking to me. So we had a number of conversations, not only about her life in the cult, but about her possession and what she described as her remarkable psychic powers. And at the end, she even said to me, at my last meeting with her, she even said to me, Richard, you know, Dr. Gallagher, I know you're a professor. If you want to write about this case, you know, please disguise my name and all that, and where I live. She didn't live in my area. In fact, she lived about 1,000 miles away. She came to our area, not exactly my home area, but to the northeast for the exorcisms. And she said, you can write about it or talk about it, which eventually I did. I like to say to people, everything I've done in this field, I've been asked to do. You know, originally see a case of what we call oppression, eventually see the case of Julia, try to help her understand what was going on with her, and eventually join the International Association of Exorcists as a non-exorcist but scientific advisor. I'm now the longest standing American member. And in fact, that's because I was pretty young at the time and the older guys have met their reward. And then eventually even a Hollywood came knocking at my door. But it was a remarkable case. I can go into some features of it if you'd like.
Right. So was it Father Jacques and Father A that brought Julia to your office just to what, rule out any underlying mental health issues before they commenced with the...
I suppose that was part of it, although if you talk to Julia, you would realize she was not sort of a psychotic individual, not dissociative, not over-imaginative. I mean, she was a pretty coherent person. So given the remarkable evidence that had already convinced them, these two priests who both worked with her, as you're implying, they already knew she was possessed. They what they wanted me to do was talk to her and explore her psychological ambivalence towards getting help. On the one hand, she herself wasn't a highly educated woman, but she was thoughtful and she was natively reasonably intelligent. She knew darn well that she was possessed and she wanted to get rid of the possession, but she kind of wanted to have her cake and eat it too, because she really didn't want to leave the cult. And in fact, she was afraid of the cult. That was part of the reason. So she kind of was a little bit betwixt and between, because what people get wrong about exorcisms, it's not magic prayers. The person also has to work at it. You have to renounce any evil or sinful behavior in your life. In a way, you yourself have to turn to our Lord for help. Any good exorcist is going to say to you, it's not myself who's driving out the evil spirit. It's ultimately God, or as we say, our Lord.
What what behaviors was she exhibiting, Julia, that convinced both Father Jacques and Father A that she was truly demonically possessed?
Let me give you an example of a few things that I witnessed myself, and of course they also witnessed. To my annoyance, the priest, Father Jacques, who was also a good friend of mine, he's also deceased, unfortunately, met his reward, I am sure, very kind man, and very educated, erudite guy. And he was a little anxious about the case, so he was petitioning me to talk to her. And I hadn't met her yet, and one night, in the middle of the night, my wife and I were in our bedroom, and we had two cats that were at the foot of the bed. And they were fairly well-behaved, placid cats. Well, all of a sudden, we're awakened by this loud screeching, and these two cats are clawing and smacking each other in a way we had never seen before. It was completely unusual. We had to separate them. we wondered if they had gotten hold of excess catnip or something. And then I didn't think much of it. And then the very next morning, never having met this woman before, and admittedly to my annoyance, Father Jacques brings her to my house. They ring the doorbell. I said to him later, please do not bring Satanists to my neighborhood.
Good advice.
And, you know, I had been planning on meeting her, you know, in a professional setting. Long story short, Father Jacques introduces her to me as I open the door. And literally the first words out of her mouth were, this Satanist woman, Julia, was, well, Dr. Gallagher, nice to meet you. And by the way, she said this with a smirk, how did you like those cats last night?
Oh, boy.
So this was a flavor of how she was. Now, I would sometimes see her going into a trance, and this voice would come out of her. Possession is the control of the body, not what we would call the soul of the individual. So obviously they're using the body in some way. So when evil spirits speak, they have to use the vocal cords of the individual. It doesn't sound like a disembodied ghost or something. And it would be sentiments expressed, something to the effect, you effing priest, I told you to leave her alone. You'll be sorry. You'll regret this. You know, it's sort of try to intimidate the priest, who was pretty unflappable, actually. And at one point, I remember the evil spirit, which I was by this point absolutely convinced was a true evil spirit, a true demon. The evil spirit called Father Jacques, you monkey priest. And it's a fair indication, Richard, of how evil spirits, who are very intelligent, you know, and I'm enough of a Catholic to believe the theological teaching that they're fallen angels, very, very smart. And they regard us as sort of monkeys. They regard us as sort of dumb beasts that they are highly superior to, and they can treat the way you would treat, you know, your worst dog in the world, so to speak. So I saw her go into these trances, but what was remarkable, again, not a little unusual even for a possession, was she had all kinds of remarkable powers just from her being a incredibly committed Satanist. And sometimes when people have these gifts, and I do believe there are gifted people from God, very spiritually holy people who are gifted. But when I asked her if she herself thought she was gifted, she said, absolutely not. She said, I get all these favors from Satan. And I even hope to be rewarded by Satan after I die. And she would talk about different powers she had. She could tell an awful lot of what we call hidden knowledge. There's a Latin word for that. I studied Latin for about 10 years. And the word is latra. What it means is that you have hidden knowledge about somebody, their past, whatever. For instance, she told me how my mother had died of ovarian cancer 20 years before, but she could do that with a lot of people. And she knew a lot of facts about people. One of the more remarkable abilities that she claimed to have, you could call it a psychic ability, I guess, is she claimed that she could see people at a distance. You know, it's sort of this occult mumbo jumbo. I can see with my third eye, by the power of Satan, people from a distance, the paranormal people, which is kind of a pseudoscientific term in my opinion, because it doesn't really explain anything. Nevertheless, the parapsychological people call this remote viewing.
Yes.
It's a little bit similar to astral projection, but not exactly the same thing. It's the ability the psychic ability that people have to see things at a distance. So by this point in our conversations, Richard, with my conversations with her, I had a kind of casual banter between us at times. I tried to make her comfortable, and she, in fact, very much liked speaking to me in these pro bono visits we'd have. And I said, look, you keep bragging about this, that you can see people from a distance, because she had just told to me that she could see Father A from a distance. And I knew he was about 100 miles away. And I said, okay, Miss Smarty Pants, tell me what he's doing now. And she kind of concentrated, and she said to me, I can see him. He's walking along the beach. He's saying his mumbo jumbo prayers. This is sort of the daily prayers that a Catholic priest is supposed to say. And he's wearing a blue windbreaker and his khaki pants. Father A, I think you may know this already. Father A was an ex-Marine, and he was a big, tough guy. I'm 6'5". I played semi-pro basketball in France. The guy dwarfed me. He was a lot bigger than me. So she described him to a T. Of course, she had met him before, but she described him to a T. And she had no idea. I mean, a normal person would have no idea what he was doing right at that moment. So I called Father A on my cell phone, and I said, hi, Father A, by the way, how are things going? What are you doing? And he said, well, Rich, normally I'd be at the rectory, but I decided unusually to take a drive to the beach, and I'm saying my prayers walking along the beach. And I said to him, and what are you wearing? And at this point, he said, who wants to know? I said, humor me, Father. Just tell me what you're wearing. He says, I have a windbreaker on. What color? Blue. And he said, I know what's going on, right? He was actually a very intuitive guy. I mean, he may have had spiritual gifts himself. And he said to me, I know what's happening. You're talking to Julia, right? She's something else, isn't she? So she had these abilities. What's a little unusual is she would display it in her normal state of mind, even when she was not like manifesting an evil spirit. Now, during the exorcisms, and I didn't get a chance to go to the exorcisms, being a busy kind of family guy and professor and, you know, very, very active psychiatrist, as I still am. And I was talking to Father Jacques on the phone once. We knew where she was. She lived about 1,000 miles away. So she'd have to come to our area for the exorcisms, which she did. And I'm talking to Father Jacques in this case. And he says to me, well, can you try to come to the exorcisms? All of a sudden, she's 1,000 miles away. That same voice came in over the landline. This was not a cell phone. This was a landline. Now, she wasn't in on the conversation. And I could recognize the voice. It was the same type of guttural version saying, didn't we tell you to leave her alone, you effing priest? You are going to be sorry. We've warned you. And it's the only time in my life, Richard, that the cliche about the hairs on the back of your neck standing up, the hairs on the back of my neck stood up. And I said to Father Jacques, I said, did you hear that? And with a certain aplomb, because that was his personality, kind of a phlegmatic guy, he said, yes, Rich, in these incredibly severe cases, this sort of thing can happen.
Wow, just like water off a duck's back, he just took it all in stride. Dr. Gallagher, we're going to take a quick time out. When we come back, we'll continue to discuss the remarkable possession of Julia. Hi there. I want to tell you about a podcast I know you're going to love. It's called The Dead Files from Travel Channel. On The Dead Files, Amy Allen and Steve DeShavi investigate the paranormal activity haunting real people and homes across the United States. Amy and Steve come from totally different perspectives when they investigate. Amy's a medium. She sees and speaks to dead people and uses this skill to find out why someone might be haunting a place. Steve is a retired homicide detective. He tackles the case from the other end of the spectrum and uses public records and witness accounts to piece together the history of the haunted location. On every episode, Steve and Amy investigate a different, real haunting to help the family struggling with its effects. On one episode in Falconer, New York, a family keeps waking up with scratches and bruises. They also see a shadow figure lurking around their home. They call Amy and Steve to investigate. Amy uses her strength as a medium to understand who the presence is coming from and why it's so angry. Separately, Steve finds out the history of the house from the townspeople and in public records. He finds that several people who lived in this house died, which matches Amy's findings. At the end of the episode, Steve and Amy share their findings and make a recommendation on whether it's safe to stay in the house or time to get out. There are so many crazy stories on The Dead Files, and what's interesting about Amy and Steve is that they investigate the hauntings from two totally different perspectives. You listen to my podcast because you love tales of the paranormal, but if you want more, listen to The Dead Files wherever you get your podcasts.
The truth will set you free. But first, it will really tick you off. Welcome back to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
And we are back with Dr. Richard Gallagher. The book is Demonic Foes, My 25 Years as a Psychiatrist Investigating Possessions, Diabolic Attacks, and the Paranormal. Before the break, Dr. Gallagher, you were talking about how Julia, the demon that inhabited Julia's body broke into a telephone conversation, a landline telephone conversation between you and Father Gallagher. He had called Father Jacques. He was imploring you to, you know, come and attend one of the exorcisms, and that voice that you had heard, that guttural voice, broke into the conversation, and he just took it all in stride. But as you say, you were the hairs in the back of your neck stood up. I mean, I don't know how I would respond to something like that. If that were to happen to me, I mean, I would never ever be the same. I would be so rattled. I would never be the same. Again, you're a board certified psychiatrist. You're a man of science. I mean, you are a Catholic, but still, when this is happening to you, what's going through your mind? What are you thinking?
Well, I remember what I was thinking at the time, Richard. Now, this was relatively early in my experience in the field. It wasn't the first rodeo. It wasn't the first possession I'd ever seen. But it was so flamboyant that I remember thinking, what the heck have I got involved in? My motivation was I was simply trying to help this woman. She went on to have a few more exorcisms. I would get reports about the exorcisms. The exorcisms continued this pattern of amazing phenomena. For instance, all the classic stuff during the exorcism. She struggled for literally 2 hours to try to break free, after originally, of course, agreeing to be held down for the exorcism. She spoke a number of foreign languages. And remarkably, these are all classic signs of the presence of an evil spirit. That is really what you're looking for. You're looking for the presence of something that cannot be explained on a human level. And I didn't see this, but about 8 or 9 salt of the earth people reported to me, including 2 nurses who were at the exorcism. They said, Rich, for 30 minutes, she levitated. She rose up in the air, and if we didn't hold her down, she would have gone higher. And then eventually she kind of gradually discerned. And people say to me, well, that's against the laws of gravity. And I said, yes, I know that. of course, you see these non-material things. Now, again, the study of material reality and doing experiments and stuff like that is the essence of a scientific mentality. As a doctor, I'm also a scientist of sorts. I believe in science. I believe in the advances of science. I certainly believe myself in evolution and in the Big Bang theory. So I'm a mainstream person in terms of science. But events in history, phenomena, especially spiritual phenomena, then it doesn't mean that they're unscientific when people report these things. And people have reported these sort of things throughout all of history. There was a famous German professor who 100 years ago wrote in a magnum opus. His name was Professor Oesterreich. And he was not a religious man, but he wrote about hundreds and hundreds of cases of possession throughout history. So when people say to me sometimes, as they do, well, Dr. Gallagher, how does it feel to be out of the mainstream? I usually say to them, well, what mainstream are you talking about? Most people in America believe in evil spirits. With some exceptions of very secular-minded and materialistic people, believers in strict materialism, most people in the world today believe in evil spirits. My book, for instance, was recently translated into Japan. Now, Japan is not a Christian country, but they believe in evil spirits. So both around the world and in history, far more the common belief than the opposite has been people believe in evil spirits. I just happen, without volunteering, in fact, I don't think it's a good idea to volunteer to be involved in this field. I've even seen some people get in trouble who do that. I do believe that the evidence throughout history, as Professor Oesterreich said 100 years ago, is in fact massive. Now, that doesn't mean that these different kind of attacks, possessions, oppressions, it doesn't mean that they aren't rare in any particular society. But like a rare disease, if you take the total sum of these cases, in fact, the historical evidence is massive. And that's what I believe. And I've been in a very unusual vantage point to realize that these phenomena, let's call them, absolutely exist in the modern age as well.
Has it changed your view about mental illness? In other words, is it possible that a certain percentage of what is diagnosed as mental illness is in fact some kind of oppression or possession?
I would say the answer to that question surprises some people. It's no. I mean, I'm a mainstream doctor. I'm a mainstream psychiatrist. I don't believe that mentally ill people, it is possible to have mental illness and a possession. So there are these exceptions, but it's the exception that proved the rule. The kind of things I see in people who imagine or their family believes they may be demonically attacked, like a psychotic individual hearing voices or a multiple personality with a supposed demonic alter, or an evil person who feels a little consumed with evil. I don't believe those people are possessed. And so in the normal course of my work, I mean, I've evaluated Richard over, I've been a very busy psychiatrist, including as the county psychiatric director where I live. I've assessed at least 25,000 people over the years. Those people are not possessed. I don't all of a sudden say to them, well, sorry, fella, you're possessed. The reason I've seen so many cases is because people who might suspect they have something, or clergy who suspect they have something, may send the case to me. And so I've had this unusual vantage of seeing a lot of cases without saying that this is a common phenomena, or I think most psychiatric patients are demonically influenced or something. I do not believe that.
Your involvement in this field and writing about it and being public about it, has it damaged you professionally?
Well, the quick answer is I don't care. I mean, I know what I'm dealing with, so I'm going to speak out. I mean, I think that I just have so much experience, Richard, that I ought to speak out, that I ought to alert people to this sort of stuff. Not that it's so common, but it also has a larger significance, if you think about it, in terms of sort of a cosmic view of what reality is really like. Has good sides and dark sides. Look, I'm a full professor. I believe I'm a very well respected. I'm certainly a very experienced psychiatrist. I teach psychotherapy. I teach psychopharmacology. I've done that for a couple of decades now. So I don't think that I'm disrespected in the field. If some people are skeptical of my views, and admittedly, psychiatrists are going to be a little skeptical because they see these people who may be saying, well, the devil's talking to me, and it's clearly a brain-based hallucination. So they overgeneralize. But on the other hand, there are a lot of psychiatrists who may be more private about it, believe what I do. And certainly most people, like yourself, for instance, you seem to offer me a respectful hearing.
So getting back to Julia's case, how many exorcisms did she undergo?
She had about 8. Now, several of them were before I even met her. And she was so ambivalent. Sometimes she wouldn't show up. And she was so ambivalent because she didn't want to leave the cult. She was afraid of the cult, that it didn't surprise any of us. That's in some ways the reason the priest wanted me to see her. It didn't surprise any of us that she wasn't making progress, so to speak. I mean, you can't make progress in this field unless you work at it. You have to reform your life. Sadly, she refused to do that. And despite the last exorcism where all kinds of things went haywire, she was speaking foreign languages, she levitated. The room was reported to me to go dark, to get very frigid for a while. It became so hot at some point. Father A said to me, "Rich, it was like being at the gates of hell." It was a very dramatic case. The evil spirits obviously did not want to let go of her. And number two, she unfortunately was unwilling to reform her life. I think she was conflicted and scared. And so eventually she told me in a meeting after the last exorcism, when she told me that I could write about the case, she said, "Dr. Gallagher, thank you for your help. You seem like a nice guy. I've been very interested in your opinion, but I just can't continue this," which was tragic if you think about it.
Right. And then you lost touch with her, and
she called a while later. She called Father Jacques. She said that she wanted to resume. Father Jacques said, you got to speak to Dr. Gallagher because we know you've been so ambivalent in the past. She told me that she wanted to resume because she had a life-threatening diagnosis of cancer. And I said to her, "Well, Julia, you've always been honest with me, but I have to check out your diagnosis," exorcism being a little bit rigorous. And then we never heard from her again, either Father Jacques or myself. So the presumption is that she died. That is our presumption, because we knew we would hear from her again if she was still alive.
So in your experience, who is most susceptible to a demonic possession, as rare as it is?
Well, it's by far people who have turned to either very evil behavior and or have gotten involved in some serious manner in something very dark and occultish, like Satanism or the Mexican death cult of Santa Muerte. I dealt with a guy who was a drug lord, and he had claimed that in his bargain, Faustian to be sure, with Satan. He had become very, very successful. He had all the women he wanted. He had all the cars he wanted, until he didn't. And he got arrested, and in prison, the chaplain diagnosed him as possessed. Now, there's a good example of a guy who, again, was involved in evil, outright criminal behavior and had turned to something dark, this Santa Muerte Mexican cult. Eventually, unlike Julia, he did return to his Catholic upbringing and got delivered. So it's a story, and it can go either way.
We'll take another time out. Dr. Richard Gallagher, the author of Demonic Foes, My 25 Years as a Psychiatrist Investigating Possessions, Diabolic Attacks, and the Paranormal.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
Dr. Richard Gallagher, we are talking about demonic possession, and how do we get a copy of Demonic Foes? This came out in 2020, I believe.
Yeah, it's been out for a while. It's a serious book, although a lot of the stories people describe as enthralling. I was very pleased that HarperCollins, which is the second biggest publishing company in the world, agreed to let me write the book I wanted to write, because it's a sobering book. And even though there are some extremely dramatic stories, I tried to make it a sober treatment as well. It's pretty widely available. You can certainly get it from HarperCollins. Most people, I suppose, get it from Amazon. It's easily available on Amazon.
So when I was doing the television episode about demonic possession, and I came down to Yonkers to meet you, we did our interview, and then I came back home, and you had arranged for Father A to reach out to me, and so that I could, over the phone, and record our conversation. And he called me, and as luck would have it, it was a dark and stormy night. I was in a big house alone. I had asked my wife to take our two small children at the time to my in-laws. I didn't want them there while this conversation was taking place. And Father A said, you know, I'm going to say a prayer before we begin this interview, because as I remember it, he explained that when you start to talk about these things, even, you can open yourself up to the possibility, I suppose, of demonic oppression. So you've been, you know, in this field for 25 years. How do you protect yourself? Just even, I mean, discussing it, or, you know, coming face to face with a case of possession, how do you protect yourself?
Well, I'm not so worried that just talking about it is all that risky. I do think that, as I mentioned earlier, Richard, first of all, I didn't volunteer. So I thought that this was a little bit providential that I get involved in the field, because it's not something I at all planned. Number two, it probably has deepened my faith. I never set myself up as a paragon, but clearly when someone like myself is involved in this, you really understand the supernatural and the demonic realities you're dealing with. But you have to have your own spiritual life. So I try to practice my faith. And I'm going to shamelessly ask your audience what I ask from a lot of people, which is I also depend on the prayers of people. I have a lot of people praying for me. And look, I don't think we have to go through life afraid of this stuff. You know, if we try to be a decent human being and don't get involved in something very shady. The great Christian writer C.S. Lewis has a nice phrase, which I quote in the book. He said, on the one hand, people make a mistake by denying the reality of this stuff. It's a real reality. But the other mistake is to get preoccupied or overly intimidated by it. And he recommended, which I recommend too, you keep a balance. You know, don't spend your whole life worrying about this. or exaggerate the significance of it. Remember the old Flip Wilson line, "The devil made me do it." Well, we have free will, and if we choose to be good people, without denying the reality of what we're dealing with, I think you can find a sort of peace of mind about this whole thing. You know, it's clearly from a philosophical or theological point of view, it's clearly a mystery. You know, I compare demons to kind of cosmic terrorists. I think when we were kids, most of us in America had very little conception that terrorists were going to attack New York City or, you know, slaughter people over in the Middle East and stuff. I think we're more aware that some human beings, because of their free will, can become evil and can become horrible. And it's no different with what the teaching is about angels. Some angels are very happy, you know, serving our Lord. Other angels rebelled against that. In a way, they wanted to be their own gods and goddesses. It's clear to me that Satan wants to be worshipped, and yet he's just a creature. So the winning side is God's side. I think I am on the winning side, which, you know, also gives me a certain peace of mind.
In any of the cases you've investigated, have the demons ever identified themselves by name?
Well, I've been to quite a few exorcisms, and eventually, if the exorcism is successful, and most are, although some are not, like Julius, although no prayer is wasted, so it wasn't a waste of time to try to help her. Yes, they're forced to identify themselves. They often lie for a while, and they've been doing this even in spiritualist circles for centuries. They'll say, well, I'm Judas Iscariot, or I'm Nero, or I'm Hitler, or I'm evil Uncle Jimmy. I even have had possessed people say to me, I'm Zeus. I had a guy who was possessed who said, do you want to speak to Zeus? I said, not particularly. So all throughout history, evil spirits have tried to intimidate and confuse people. What's interesting to me is observing exorcisms. And no exorcist will say it's because of his inherent power. He's working with the prayers and the support of the church. But ultimately, the person who delivers people is God, or we would say our Lord. And under the influence of our Lord, the demon reluctantly is forced to admit who they are and what their name is. It's not so much that there's something magical about learning the name. It's that when the demon is being forced to reveal their name, what you know is then they're having to submit. They're having to submit to God's power. And so you've started to turn the tide that they're no longer in charge. It's our Lord who's in charge, because they're being forced to admit who they really are. And usually the prognosis after that is pretty good.
What happens to the demon once it is exorcised, taken out of the victim? Is it free to inhabit, to possess someone else, or is it sent, I don't know, to Hades? What happens?
Well, again, it's kind of a mystery, but I would say probably either course is possible. I do think they try to attack other human beings if they can. They seem to get a sadistic pleasure out of it. It's almost like a human sadist who gets pleasure out of tormenting people. But certainly, I think some of them go back to hell. I do believe that. And the reason is, again, you know, why does hell exist? It exists because God allows us to be free. God doesn't force himself on people. And strange as it sounds, he allows a certain amount of evil. You know, why did he allow a Hitler? Why does he allow cancer? Well, it's not like he wants these things, but he allows human freedom. And I think he has allowed freedom of angels too, even to corrupt themselves. And so they kind of choose their own place, as it's sometimes been expressed. And presumably, yes, presumably they go back to their own kind.
I don't know if you care to answer this or whether it's possible to answer this, but do you believe that exorcisms can only be successfully performed by Catholic priests?
No, I don't. I think I have met a number of Protestant ministers who have reported to me successful cases. There were Jewish exorcists in history. There were also, there's not too many today. There were also, there's also Islamic imams who have a very similar beliefs to what we believe about evil spirits, who I have observed have successfully dealt with some cases. It may be that God allows sincere, holy people in any faith tradition to have some success. I do know at the same time that an awful lot of people in the modern world do prefer to refer people to either a Catholic priest or what's called an Eastern Orthodox priest, who clearly feel they have special authority from our Lord. I mean, our Lord definitely commissioned people in his church to deliver evil spirits. He made a major distinction, by the way, in the Gospels. It's very clear. He healed some people, and I believe he did. But driving out demons were not healing people. It was a different thing. They were two different things. And he did promise that in the church, he would give the church authority to drive out spirits. So I do believe that's the best way to get rid of a spirit. But look, a lot of people in history have never heard of Jesus Christ. So I think in other cases, also by the power of God, he probably has allowed some successful deliverances to other faith traditions as well. That's my personal opinion, which is, again, none of the opinions I'm giving you, Richard, are just my opinion. These tend to be the authoritative teachings of at least the Catholic and the Orthodox churches.
Are there any cases of children in your book, Demonic Foes? Have you ever been involved in a case involving a child being possessed?
I think it's rare. I certainly think that some children have been demonically attacked, probably to the extent of a possession. This is where you get into a whole nother possible cause where some people think that they've been cursed by someone in their family, you know, maybe a grandmother who was a dark practitioner. I do think it's possible that that sort of thing happened. I can't say that I've seen a lot of those cases, but certainly they've been reported to me, and they often do quite well if they get help. I mean, that underscores for me in particular that evil spirits even want to attack and corrupt innocent children. I mean, it's horrific when you think about it.
Father A and Father Jacques, as you say, are no longer with us. What is happening to the order of exorcists within the Catholic Church? Are there younger priests coming up? I don't know, not a dying art. What am I trying to say here? Are there replacements? Are there reinforcements on the way?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, there are more exorcists, official exorcists in America than ever before. It's not a lot. But they have to be appointed by a bishop. They're chosen very carefully. When I started sort of advising on these cases, there really were very few. That's why Father Jacques and Father A would see a lot of cases. It's part of why I got so experienced after just a few years. And again, over the years, I've dealt with a lot of different exorcists who've asked my advice. Sometimes it's obvious they don't need my advice, but other times the case may be tricky enough. So it is true that around the world, at least in the Catholic Church, there are many, many more officially appointed exorcists than ever before.
Finally, not that you know we're necessarily going to convince anyone one way or the other, but for skeptics out there listening, and they're likely materialists, but are not inclined to believe what they're hearing right now, what would you say to them?
I tell people to just keep an open mind and look at the evidence. I mean, there's the evidence in my book, but there's evidence of a lot of exorcists who write openly about this stuff now. I mean, it was almost like a hidden area that people didn't want to write about. Now people understand that there's so much spiritual confusion in the modern world, at least in the modern Western world, that they need to examine the evidence. I know a Christian theologian, a Protestant, who spent a lot of time in Africa, and he said, in Africa, you don't have any problem convincing people about evil spirits. And he said something interesting. He said, Africa probably in this area has something to teach the skeptical West. So I'm not asking anybody even to take my word for it. Just examine the evidence. This Professor Osterreich, who wrote about and referenced, you know, thousands of cases throughout history, literally, he wasn't even a religious man, but he accepted that there was some transcultural similarity in these cases throughout all cultures, so that the evidence was massive. And that's what he concluded. The evidence is massive. I believe the same thing. I believe that you have to keep an open mind about this, because let's face it, this is not a happy subject, and it has implications that people don't really want to accept. So you have to examine your own skepticism and prejudices. But I think if you really keep an open mind and you're interested in the evidence, this is what the great mathematician Pascal said, that there is enough evidence to convince somebody who's truly wanting to know the answer to these questions.
And for those wanting to know the answer, they might start with Demonic Foes, My 25 Years as a Psychiatrist Investigating Possessions, Diabolic Attacks, and the Paranormal, published by HarperCollins. Dr. Richard Gallagher, the author. Thank you so much. Great meeting you again, and great speaking with you again.
Well, you're welcome, Richard. Thank you for a thoughtful interview once again.
A new Richard Sarrett's Strange Planet drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Subscribe at StrangePlanetPodcast.com.